Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Accessibility Online webinar series. My name is Peter Berg with the Great Lakes ADA Center. I want to welcome all of you to today's session. The Accessibility Online webinar series is a collaboration between the National ADA Network and the United States Access Board. The National ADA Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Education's National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. So again, we welcome all of you to today's session. A few items before we go ahead and get started. Today's session is being recorded and archive will be made available in the future on the Accessibility Online website. For those of you needing to use the captioning feature within the Illuminate system to participate in today's session, you need to click on the captioning icon in the window, and you can resize and relocate that captioning window wherever you need to. We please ask participants to not use the emoticons within the Illuminate system. They can be problematic for individuals who are participating using assistive technology, and it can also be distracting for other participants. For individuals participating today using a screen reader, you can follow along with the PowerPoint presentation in the activity window. To open up the activity window, you need to do the keystroke combination of control slash. And then the final item is the chat area. While the chat area is not visible to you, you can still submit questions to the speakers while the presentation is going on, and they encourage you to submit questions as the presentation is happening. The best way to get your specific questions answered, as with all of our webinar Accessibility Online sessions, is to submit your questions in advance. The speakers then have a chance to review them, and where possible, they do their absolute best to incorporate them into the presentation. But you can still submit questions as the presentation is going along. So that is it for me. We've done all the testing, Peggy, and now it's time to move on to the exciting topic today of doors. And so at this point, I will turn it over to Peggy Greenwell with the U.S. Access Board. Peggy?
Thanks, Peter, and welcome everyone to this month's webinar session on accessible doors and maneuvering clearances. We want to thank everyone for all the questions that were submitted in advance, and as Peter mentioned, we will be addressing those questions to the extent possible throughout the presentation. I want to just add one hitch, I guess, to what Peter just mentioned about submitting questions during the presentation. I think we'd prefer if you wait towards the end of the presentation, since many of your questions are likely to be answered during the presentation, and then we can hold the last portion of our session together for live questions that our presenters will respond to. So if you can hold those questions towards the end of the presentation, we would appreciate it. At this point, I want to introduce our presenters today. We have Scott Winley, who is an accessibility specialist with the board. He has been here since 1997, has an architecture degree from the University of Idaho, and in addition to all his responsibilities as an accessibility specialist, he's also spearheading our rulemaking and public rights of way. Dave Anchulis is also presenting today, and he's been with the board since 1988. And has served as the coordinator of research, been involved in nearly every rulemaking here at the board. He develops a lot of our technical assistance material, and he also serves as our public affairs coordinator. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Dave.
Thanks, Peggy. On slide 3, we have an overview of today's program on accessible doors. Scott and I will be talking about where accessible doors are required, and we're also going to review the technical requirements for both manual doors and automated doors, and then from there move on to questions that come in during the session. Now, slide 4. The basis for the program today are the new requirements in the latest version of the ADA standards. As many of you probably know by now, the Department of Justice implemented their latest version, the 2010 ADA standards, last September. They will become mandatory next March, March 15th, 2012. And so the provisions we'll be talking about today can be found in those new standards. Now, those standards are derived from the board's ADA and ABA accessibility guidelines that were put out back in 2004. Now, while in some areas there are some slight differences, with respect to doors, there aren't. So if you're looking at requirements in the board's 2004 guidelines or DOJ 2010 standards, there is no difference in the provisions for doors. And I do want to point out that the effective date for DOJ's 20 standards is tied to the permitting dates in the case of private sector facilities. So keep in mind that March 15th, 2012 pertains to the date by which the final permit application is either certified as complete or is when it's submitted in jurisdictions that don't certify completion. If there is no permit required, that date pertains to the physical start of construction or alteration. So it's important to keep that in mind because a lot of projects just getting underway now in terms of design may likely want to follow the 2010 standards in view of when they take effect. Now on slide 5 outlines the other ADA and ABA standards that are in effect. Besides DOJ's 2010 standards, which apply to most facilities covered by the ADA, the Department of Transportation also maintains very similar standards. They put their latest version out back in 2006. And the DOT standards apply to transportation facilities such as bus stops and stations, rail stations, those facilities that are involved in designated public transportation. If it's not a transit facility and covered by the ADA, then it's subject to DOJ standards. And we also have very similar standards issued for the federal sector under an earlier law, the Architectural Barriers Act, and they too have been updated and are very similar to what's now most recently in effect on the ADA side. There are some differences. The only exception is the case of housing, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development has yet to update the standards, which means the original standards, known as the UFAS, Uniform Federal Accessibility Standards, still remain in effect for housing. Otherwise, other facilities covered by the ABA are subject to the latest version. Now, on slide 6, we explain the scoping provisions for doors and entrances, and we just want to point out here that scoping for doors is located in Section 206, Accessible Routes. In the new standards, the scoping for accessible routes has been structured so that components of accessible routes, doors, elevators, and so forth, are actually part of the same section. So you have to look at 206 for scoping requirements, and that happens to be on page 55 in DOJ standards, which are available on DOJ's website. If you're looking at the board's ADA ABA guidelines, they can be found on page 23 for ADA facilities. Now, on the next slide, slide 7, we have outlined door scoping as contained in section 206.5. Now, the requirements for accessible doors apply to doors that provide user passage. So in the case of, say, for example, closets, they would only apply to closet doors that are intending to for people to actually pass through, like a walk-in closet. If they're not intended for user passage, then such doors would be subject to provisions for storage in terms of the hardware, operability, clear floor space, but not all the other requirements we'll be talking about today. Now, the scoping provisions require compliance at accessible entrances and for accessible rooms and spaces, at least one door or doorway must be accessible. and access is also required at doors along accessible routes and accessible means of egress. On slide 8, door scoping is also including requirements that are specific to transient lodging, such as hotels and motels and residential facilities. Now, in the case of transient lodging, all guest room doors, not just accessible unit doors, but all guest room doors must have a clear width for access of at least 32 inches. Now, for the non-accessible rooms, that's the only requirement that applies. Other provisions for doors concerning hardware, maneuvering clearance, et cetera, they don't apply to the inaccessible rooms. It's just the door clear width. And the reason for this provision is that it allows visibility among guests at a hotel, motel. Now, for dwelling units, we have a requirement that the accessible units have all doors comply. Even if it's a space that is not required to comply within the accessible dwelling unit, we are requiring that all doors comply so that occupants can get to all spaces even if a certain space is not fully accessible. In addition, with residential facilities, it's required that at least one primary entrance to a dwelling unit be accessible. We did get some questions submitted in advance about screen doors, which is typically found at dwelling units, and we do require that where a screen door is provided that you have the clearance, width, and so forth that would apply to such a door. But we don't regard a screen door and the main door as doors in series, and that was something that was specifically asked. And we'll talk more about doors in series later in the program. Now, slide 9. We just want to recap here which entrances have to be accessible. In new construction, at least 60% of public entrances must comply. And a public entrance is pretty broadly defined as really any entrance other than a service or restricted entrance. So in a lot of cases, for example, an employee use entrance is often going to be considered part of the 60% scoping as a public entrance. Service entrances are defined as those where delivery of goods or services are provided. Now on slide 10, we list some additional requirements that apply on top of the 60% scoping. And so the standards require that direct access from parking structures where provided have accessible entrances. And if a facility has direct access from tunnels or elevated walkways, those entrances must be accessible as well. Again, this is in addition to the 60%. And we have criteria unique to transit facilities and entrances serving different fixed routes. There's also a requirement that each entrance to a tenant in a multi-tenant facility be accessible. And we also require that where provided, at least one restricted entrance and one secured entrance be accessible. Restricted entrance would be those where use of the entrance is controlled, where someone has to get some type of clearance to actually gain entry to the facility. So that's what is meant by a restricted entrance. Slide 11. Okay, we have here on slide 11 information concerning secured entrances, and there is an exception. Doors operated only by security personnel are not required to meet provisions for accessible hardware, closing speed, opening force. And this exception is provided because it anticipates that such doors are not going to require independent operation by public or other users. Now, if a door is automated and operated only by security personnel, then the only requirements they are subject to would be the clear width and threshold provisions. Slide 12. We want to outline here those rooms or spaces that are not required to comply at all, because if a space is exempt, then of course the door or entry to it would not have to comply. These exceptions are, most are located in section 203 of the standards, and that section includes exemptions for areas that are raised for security, life, or fire safety, like a prison guard tower. Certain machinery and equipment spaces are also exempt if they're only accessed for repair or occasional monitoring of equipment, and we have some exceptions.
It seems that we have lost Dave's sound there, and please be patient with us as we attempt to identify what happened with Dave. So please hold on for a moment while we try to figure out what has happened.
Peter, do we have audio on this microphone?
Yes, Peggy. Able to hear you loud and clear on that microphone. Thank
okay.
you for that. Oh, go ahead, Dave.
Okay, sorry about the interruption. We switched mics here. And can you hear me okay?
Dave, your sound is very good. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry about that. Okay, so in case of exceptions, in Section 203, these types of spaces, if they qualify, would not have to have compliant doors. Slide 13. With respect to work areas, they are not fully exempt. But work areas used only by employees as a work area, under the ADA standards, have to have an accessible entrance, including doors or gates. But other provisions with respect to work areas or in the standards do not apply to work areas. Slide 14. Now, stairwells, many doors on stairwells are not required to comply because they're not part of an accessible route. Stairs are not considered part of an accessible route. There are some situations, though, when your stairway doors would have to comply. If they're part of an accessible route, say, to an area refuge located on the stairwell, then those doors would have to comply. Or if there's an accessible means of egress that runs through that door, if you have an exit from the building off that portion of the stairs, then that would require access and compliant doors. But aside from that, if there's nothing requiring an accessible route through a stairwell door, then those doors do not have to comply. Slide 15. Now, the doors covered by the standards include manual doors, those that are hinged, swinging doors, sliding doors, folding doors. They're covered in 404.2. The standards also covered automated doors, either those that are fully powered or those that are lower energy power assisted, and Scott's going to review more of those requirements later in the program. And also, gates are equally covered by this section. So a lot of the provisions we're talking about today apply equally not only to doors but to gates as well. One type of door that can't be part of an accessible route are revolving doors. And this includes those that are automated. Sometimes you see those larger automated types at hotels and other types of facilities. They may be usable for access from a practical standpoint, but they are not recognized by the standards as an acceptable alternative. So if you have a revolving door, even if it's automated, you must have an accessible door, manual door, or other type of automated door as an alternative to the revolving door. Slide 16. So we're going to begin our review of the requirements for manual doors. And slide 17, beginning with clear width. Each accessible door or active leaf of double door, at least one, must have a clear width of at least 32 inches. Now, the clear width is measured from the face of the door to the stop, with the door being open 90 degrees. And we do have an exception that allows a 5/8 inch maximum projection into existing doors or in alterations, and that's permitted on the latch side. Slide 18. The clear width also applies to folding doors and sliding doors, and this is measured it's applying to the opening, so it's measured to the hardware in the case of something like a folding door as well as a sliding door. Slide 19. The standards have been clarified to explain where projections are permitted into the clear width. Above 34 inches, we do permit a limited projection of 4 inches into the doorway opening. Now, below 34 inches, you cannot have any projections, and the reason for that is that the widest part of an occupied wheelchair is at the lower height, so that's why we don't allow any projections below 34 inches. Above, it's limited to 4 inches. Now, with this clarification, it's indicating that certain projections, and you see this often with something like panic hardware that run the width of the door, can be factored in and count as an acceptable projection into the space. Now, the clearance must extend at least 8 inches above the floor. The only exception recognized is that we do allow a protrusion of the closer or stops of up to 2 inches down to 78 inches above the floor. Those are the only areas where you can have a protrusion in the clear opening width of doors. Slide 20. Now, the clear width of a minimum 32 inches applies up to a depth of 2 feet. If you have a deep passageway doorway that's more than 2 feet deep, then your clear width increases from 32 inches to 36 inches, and this is consistent with specifications for other aspects of accessible routes. Slide 21. Now, maneuvering clearance is covered in Section 404.2.4, and this is where we get a lot of questions when we're talking about doors. Maneuvering clearances are specified to give enough space so that people with disabilities, including those who use mobility aids and wheelchairs, have space to position at the door to reach and operate hardware and then maneuver on through the door. Slide 22. Now, these clearances accommodate all types of mobility aids. And here on this slide, you can see that the space also is of use when one is using mobility aids such as crutches, canes, walkers. In particular, that space beyond the latch side is helpful because of the positioning. It allows someone to better center at the hardware and to begin opening the door. So these spaces requirements we're talking about benefit a wider range of users. Slide 23. Now, the maneuvering clearance is specified based on the approach and the swing of the door. For forward approaches, more space is required on the pull side because it requires more space to pull open the door. And that space must be at least 5 feet deep. And the strike side clearance must be at least 18 inches. On the push side, the maneuvering clearance must be at least 4 feet deep. And if a door has both a closer and a latch, then 12 inches strike side clearance is needed. If a door doesn't have both a closer and a latch, there is no additional strike side clearance required. Now, we have received the question about whether something like spring-loaded hinges qualify as a closer, and we basically interpret the standard as saying that any device that effectively helps return the door to a closed position, and in the case of forward approach, has a latch, then would be required to have the 12-inch strike side clearance in the case of a forward approach. Slide 24. Now, all maneuvering clearances are illustrated in the standards for all types of approaches, forward, latch side, hinge side approaches. They're also detailed for swing doors, folding, sliding doors, as well as doorways, passageways without doors. These requirements apply to all doors and including some automated doors, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. They also apply to fire doors. There is an exception for fire doors that's limited only to the opening force. So we did receive a question in advance about fire doors, including those that are held in an open position most of the time. They would still be required to comply with maneuvering clearances. Slide 25. Now, determining approaches at a door, if you are in a space that's at least 5 feet deep measured from the wall the door is in, you can go with a forward approach as opposed to the latch or hinge side approach. And the reason we interpret it this way is because 60 inches minimum is the amount of space needed to make a right angle turn in a wheeled mobility aid. So if a corridor or other type of space off a door provides at least 60 inches, then it's providing space to approach that door in a forward manner. Slide 26. Now, the maneuvering clearance applies to the full height, so it's important that nothing project into the maneuvering clearance up the full height. And the only change in level allowed within the maneuvering clearance is the threshold at a doorway. No other changes in level are permitted within the maneuvering clearance. Slide 27. Now, the maneuvering clearance is measured from the wall the door is in. And we did receive some questions about whether it's measured to the baseboard or molding. We interpret the standards as requiring measurement from the wall surface. Now, most base molding of a standard type that may be installed later after construction would not have to be factored in. But if you have a more significant type of base molding that's more architectural, that has a greater profile from the wall and is something that is being specified in design, then that should be factored in, and the maneuvering clearance should be measured away from something like that where it's more significant. But otherwise, aside from that kind of condition, the maneuvering clearance is measured from the wall. And we do specify a maximum offset from the available maneuvering clearance and the surface of the door of 8 inches. Slide 28. If your offset is greater than 8 inches, as shown in this slide, then you need to provide the maneuvering clearance for a forward approach, and that maneuvering clearance has to be provided closer to the door. It cannot be provided more than 8 inches from the door. Slide 29. Now, here in this slide on the left, we see a recess that is up to 8 inches. This one is caused by the wall thickness, but keep in mind that offsets can be created by other fixed elements. It could be casework, it could be a shallow shelf, it could be other elements. It's not just a wall, but anything that creates an offset of the maneuvering clearance of 8 inches or more, or more than 8 inches from the door surface, requires recessing of the space, and that you see on the right hand of the slide, where in this case, because the recess is greater than 8 inches, the space has had to be provided so that the maneuvering clearance is notched in and closer to the door. It's preferable that the maneuvering clearance be as close to the door surface as possible. But again, the end point, the dividing line, is that 8-inch specification. Slide 30. Now, there is one exception permitted for medical facilities, specifically hospital patient bedrooms. And those rooms do not have to meet the maneuvering clearance. The reason for that, and that's on the latch side clearance. The reason for that is that because of the type of layout of these rooms and the fact that most doors are wider in a medical facility to accommodate gurneys and stretchers is the reason that they're permitted this latch side clearance exception. But it's limited only to hospital patient rooms. Slide 31. Now, the maneuvering clearance must be accommodated on door and entrance landings. And it's important to try and keep the maneuvering space away from drop-offs, stair openings. So we recommend that you configure space at landing so that one does not have to maneuver close to the edge of any drop-off in opening the doors and proceeding through entrance doors. Slide 32. And another consideration is maneuvering clearance in the relationship to ramp approaches. Now, door maneuvering clearances and ramp landings, they can overlap, but we do recommend that the door not swing into the ramp landing, because someone coming off a ramp could get hit by the door if the door is swinging into that space. It's not specifically prohibited, but we do recommend that you keep door swings out of ramp landings. Slide 33. Thresholds are covered by the standards, and they must be a maximum of one half inch and have a beveled edge of 1 to 2 maximum. If a threshold is only a quarter inch high or less, then it can have a straight edge. And the standards do allow a slightly higher threshold in the case of existing or altered facilities. And that's a maximum of 3/4 inch. The reason for that is because making an existing threshold comply in an existing facility could necessitate replacement of the full door assembly. So that's why that allowance is permitted in the case of existing facilities. Now, we did get a question submitted about whether the threshold height applies to all guest rooms in transient lodging. It does not. The threshold requirements and the other door requirements apply only to the wheelchair accessible units in a transient lodging facility. The only thing required of inaccessible guest rooms is the door clear width. Slide 34. Now, the standards also address space between doors and series. And doors and series, these provisions are specific to doors that are directly opposite each other in something like an entry vestibule. And the standards require at least a 4-foot separation between the swing of doors. And this is important because it is allowing enough space so that someone can get beyond one door before and its swing before encountering the next. Otherwise, they may have to contend with the weight of one door while trying to proceed and begin opening the other. slide 35. This separation applies to all types of configurations, whether the doors swing in the same direction, away from each other, or towards each other. In all cases, you need at least a 4-foot minimum separation. Slide 36. Now, other types of vestibules where maybe doors are on adjacent walls are not subject to this 4-foot minimum separation. However, it is recommended that you provide enough space, wheelchair space, beyond the swing of one door so that one can get clear it before encountering the next, which is really the same logic of the 4-foot separation in the case of doors that are opposite each other. Slide 37. Now, one thing we do want to clarify, too, is that maneuvering clearances at doors can overlap. So that's really not an issue. It's what's more important is door swing and providing enough space beyond one door before encountering another one in vestibule and other types of configurations. Slide 38. Now, there are requirements for doors that are specific to toilet rooms, bathrooms, and dressing rooms. And in the case of dressing rooms and single-user toilet or bathrooms, the door cannot swing into the fixture clearances unless you have wheelchair space beyond the arc of the door swing. Slide 39. And this slide is illustrating that alternative. So if you have, say, a single-user toilet room, the door can swing into the fixture clearances if you have the wheelchair space available beyond the door swing that is unobstructed. And this, too, is allowing space for someone to get beyond the door and close it and not have to contend with other fixtures being in the way or anything like that. Now, the requirement that doors not swinging into fixture clearances is limited to just fixture clearances, like the space required at the lav or at the toilet. It does not apply to turning space. Doors can always swing into turning space under the new standards. Slide 40. Now, stall doors, toilet stall doors, are also held to the requirements in 404 for manual doors. And there's some additional provisions in the toilet stall section, section 604.8. Toilet stall doors must be self-closing, and the new standards now require a door pull on both sides of the door on the latch side. And the door can't swing into the minimum stall area. And the standards show the possible locations of the door. The door can be in the front partition, which is usually how it's located, but it must be offset from the corner the toilet's in. That's allowing space for someone to enter the stall, get through the door. And you also have a optional door location on the side partition that is further away from the toilet. Slide 41. Now, all the requirements in 404 apply to toilet stall doors, but there is one change called out in the toilet stall section, and that change says that you can have a 42-inch minimum clearance for latch side approaches. Otherwise, other doors for latch side approaches, in most cases, you need at least a 48-inch clearance. But because toilet stall doors are lighter and the maneuvering through them is somewhat easier than full doors, this change is permitted. Slide 42. Now, the regular stall that's based on the minimum size, the door is required to swing out. But when you have an end of the row stall or another stall that is sized larger, then the door is permitted to swing in. And in this slide, you see an end of row stall design that allows the door to swing in because this door is not swinging into the minimum footprint required for the space of the toilet. Otherwise, if the door is required to swing out in the case of toilet stalls. And with the next slide, 43, Scott is going to pick up with door hardware.
Okay, we're going to give Dave a break, and I'm going to take over for a while. We're on hardware, slide 43. And we require, it's 40427, we require one hand operation, no tight grasping, pinching, or twisting of the wrist, 5 pounds maximum force to operate the hardware, and the height is specified between 34 and 48 inches. So we used to just say that it met the reach ranges. I guess we changed that because sometimes somebody might stick a handle really low. I'm just kidding. But so we specify a minimum height and a maximum height, which is a slight change from the previous guidelines. And also, when we're talking about, we received some questions about locks. And in regards to how, you know, if there's three locks in a hotel, are all three of them required to meet these requirements? And if it's in an accessible room, we would say that, yes, they do need to meet those requirements because you're expecting the occupant to use it. Thus, you know, if it's an accessible room, all the hardware for that door needs to be compliant. Next slide, the slide 44. Now, with hardware, there's all kinds of different hardware that can meet these requirements. Levers, pulls, and other types comply. Things that are not compliant are rounded knobs or, you know, where you actually have to do any tight maneuvers to get in to use the hardware. We had a question about panel hardware, where and we would consider panel hardware to be accessible as long as there's space between the panel and the door to be able to get your fingers or slightly, you know, closed fist into that space, and then that would be acceptable. The important thing with hardware here, and whether it meets the requirements, is whether you can get your hand into it to be able to operate it with your hand being closed. So next slide is slide 45. And we talk about this loose or closed fist, a loose grip operability. That's really kind of your test, but it's not absolute. The requirements, it's a good test to be able to test your hardware, but it's not absolutely required. What is required is that it be operable without the tight grasping, pinching, or twisting of the wrist, and the other stuff that we talked about in slide 43. So this is just a good test of your hardware, but not required. Closing speed. With closers, we have, you know, there are times when the doors with closers are going to close after you get through them, and we want them to not close so hard and fast that they become a problem. So the specifications is a 5 second minimum from 90 degrees to 12 degrees. And when you have, so that's where you have a door closer. Now, with there is different requirement for spring hinges. This is the next slide, slide 47. And it specifies that you have 1.5 seconds from 70 degrees to the closed position. Now, this is consistent with the industry standard. And the reason why we changed that is because that's what is is specified both in ICC and in the ANSI BHMA standards for door closing speeds. And if we go to slide 48, opening force is 5 pounds maximum for, it applies to all interior doors, and also the 5 pounds of force applies to exterior doors when they are sliding or folding. The only exception, or the only time we don't specify, there are very few exceptions where we don't specify the 5 pounds of force, and that is both with fire doors, and but they are required, fire doors are required to be adjusted to the maximum or the minimum that they can be that's required by code. So if your fire marshal says they have to be 15 pounds, then they have to be 15 pounds of force to open them. The other thing that we don't regulate is exterior hinge doors. It's very important to, we had some questions about this, several questions about the opening force, specifically on sliding doors. And, you know, the sliding door provision, it, whether it's exterior or interior, a sliding folding door has to meet the 5 pounds of force. The only one that doesn't have to meet the 5 pounds of force, again, are the exterior hinged door and the fire doors. And when we talk about fire doors, we're talking about fire-rated assemblies and or fire-rated walls. So if the fire marshal deems it a fire door, then it should be treated with this exception, and you would have to follow the person having jurisdiction over that, which may be your fire marshal or someone else with that authority. Next slide. Slide 49. Also in regards to opening force, again, exterior doors, since we don't specify a maximum force on those, we always encourage in technical assistance that we that you try to adjust it as light as it can be and still remain closed with all the forces that are being applied to it. But one of the things that we would recommend, it's not required, but we would recommend automation for exterior doors. It just makes them easier to use. And just for FYI, General Services Administration, when they adopted our guidelines back in 2006, I believe it is, they actually require their buildings to have automated doors in the exterior entry doors. So that's a good thing. Now the opening force, slide 50. Slide 50 talks about the opening force, that it applies to a continuous opening force. It doesn't apply to the initial force to overcome inertia. So when you're adjusting or testing the door, you need to remember that, as well as it doesn't involve the force to extract the bolt or disengage devices holding the door in the closed position. Slide 51 talks about ways that you can test your opening force. There are several devices available for measuring opening force. I've used actually both of these in my career. You have a door gauge and tensionometers, and a fish scale can actually be used as well. So those are devices that would be usable to test your opening force. And slide 52. Door surfaces, we talk about that the door surfaces of the bottom 10 inches must be smooth, the full width of the door. Kick plates can be used to protect the door. If any of you have any experience with wheelchairs and doors, they don't mix real well and they tend to scrape up doors. So, you know, kick plates can be used, but whether you put in a kick plate or not, it does require, the guidelines do require that the 10 inches need to be smooth. And that means not having anything that you could catch with your footrest or your foot or a caster. So door stops shouldn't really be on the side of the door that you're pushing against. There are ways to hold open a door other than the type of door stops that are sticking out on the push side of the door. That's a question we also received. Now, in the next slide, slide 53, the bottom surface of the door, we have some exceptions. Sliding doors are not required to have a smooth bottom surface. Of course, that's because we're not pushing against it. Some tempered glass doors without stiles. Stiles are those vertical elements that you see on some glass doors. The vertical elements can become a catch for your foot or your footrest as a person is pushing against the door. We also exempt existing doors and doors that don't extend to the 10 inches after finished floor. So those types of doors you'd see sometimes when you have doors into work areas that are actually raised, that there's openings at the bottom where it doesn't get down to 10 inches. We wouldn't require those to be smooth. Next slide, slide 54, is we're talking about vision lights. Vision lights are not required. It's an if-provided situation, so if it's provided, those vision lights need to be at 43 inches maximum, the bottom edge of the visible surface. And it's also not required if the bottom edge is above 66 inches. So we had some questions earlier about vision lights and having them in fire doors. We would recommend that if you're providing the vision lights, we would expect it to comply with the 43 inch max requirement. You would just want to do a narrower vision light to meet the square inches requirement that's in fire doors. We're going to next slide, slide 55, I believe, is we're going to go into some other requirements. And so the next slide, slide 56, signs. We have a provision for signing doors. Labels are required for to have directional information with the International Symbol of Accessibility if not all entrances are accessible. So really technically in a fully accessible building, and if all the entrances are accessible, there is no need for signage. But we do require the signage to be provided if not all doors are accessible. The way you can show the direction can be done both with a figure or with words to say, you know, it's around the corner on the Adams Street entrance or something like that. Or it can just be as simple as an arrow if it's fairly clear, if that arrow gives you enough information to know where you need to go. The next slide, slide 57, talks about two-way communication systems. If they do have a two-way communication system, it needs to have both visual and audible signals so that you know that there's redundancy in knowing if the request for communication has been received. And in notification devices, there's some in the next slide, 58, there is some requirements, and Dave, would you mind covering these two slides real quick? Check off.
Yes, on this slide, 52, we have summarized requirements for notification devices in the standards. Now, they are specific to transient lodging and residential dwelling units. In the case of transient lodging, those guest rooms that are required to have communication access, not wheelchair access or mobility access, but communication access, they must have a notification device that is visible as both audible, visible signals to indicate a door knock, a doorbell. For residential dwelling units, those that are required to provide communication access must have a hardwired electric doorbell that has audible and visual signals. And they're also required to provide a means for occupants to identify visitors without having to open the door. So this could be achieved by things like windows or vision panels or peepholes, door scopes. But these provisions are, in the case of residential, are limited to those units that are required to provide communication accessible features. Slide 59. Now, we did get some questions in advance of the webinar, and we do so on our TA line about peepholes. The standards do not address or regulate peephole heights in other types of doors, including those that serve wheelchair accessible guest rooms or dwelling units. Now, there are products available that can facilitate access. There are types of door scopes with prisms or fisheye lenses that provide a wide angle view and don't allow or don't require the people to actually be close to it to see through it. So these devices, you can be several feet away and are usable from both a standing and seated position, and they offer greater access. But the standards do not require that, say, you provide a secondary peephole at a lower height. And we don't even really recommend that as an alternative to something like a door scope lens, because if you have a lower peephole, it's not necessarily going to give good visibility to identify who's on the other side of that door. And even if a peephole is lowered, it may be difficult from someone from a seated position to actually, you know, reach it and peer closely through it. So we don't generally recommend the lower peephole over something like a door scope. Slide 60. The standards also require an accessible route at entrances that have security barriers or screening devices. And so because some of these devices can accommodate various types of mobility aids, we do then require that an alternative accessible route be provided around such devices if they can't accommodate accessible routes themselves. Slide 61. It's important to keep in mind that other types of barriers, like bollards, and that have become more common in various locations, especially at government buildings, cannot obstruct accessible routes to entrances. So it's important to keep in mind the requirements for accessible routes and making sure that they're provided through barrier types of devices.
Thanks, Dave. This is Scott again, coming back to you. We're going to talk about automated doors, slide 62 and then slide 63. we're talking about automatic and power-assisted doors. There are two different types of doors. We'll talk about the differences. But the requirements, just an overview of the requirements for an automatic door. Thresholds, same as manual door. Doors in series is the same as manual doors. Clear width is similar as well. We have some breakout opening requirements for automatic doors that we'll talk about. And controls, maneuvering clearances are a little bit different requirements. And then we have the ANSI-BHMA standards for safety and operation, which that's where we get the two different types of doors from. Let's start with slide 64. clear width. Of course, the clear width for an automatic door is the same as a manual door, 32 inches minimum in power on and power off mode. This is important that it's for both conditions. So if you have a situation where you have multiple leaves opening, or two leaves, if both leaves open when activated, the clear width is based on the opening provided by all leaves in the open position. Now, but along with that is on the next slide, slide 65, we talk about the breakout opening. Doors and means of egress are required to have a 32-inch minimum clear breakout opening, in other words, in the emergency mode when the automation part of the doors is non-functional. We require that the breakout opening provide a 32-inch minimum clearance. We give exceptions for that if the door has standby power, of course, because then the door, if it has standby power, it's going to function the same way as it does when it's not an emergency situation. And we also don't require it to provide this breakout opening if it is if there's a compliant manual door that serves the same means of egress. So if it's not the only door available, we don't require the breakout opening. And in the next slide, slide 66, we talk about wheelchair space that controls and that it needs to be outside the door swing so that a person doesn't have to immediately move after they've pushed the button to avoid having the door hit them. So this is a requirement that we didn't specify in the past. And as we all know, there are several doors, automatic doors out there that have the buttons placed in such odd places that you have to really work around that. So we've tried to address this. This is a new requirement in the provisions of actually specifying that there be clear space beyond the swing of the door for the button. Now, we had a question about other devices like card readers or fob readers for security entries, and we would recommend that you would treat those the same as, although it's not specifically covered in the guidelines, we would recommend that you treat them the same as an automatic door controller and have the clear floor space outside the swing of the door, because if you have to swipe your card to get access, again, you don't want the door necessarily to have to be in the way of the door swing. So in the next slide, slide 67, we show kind of a better location sometimes for the control, if it's possible. Is it on an adjacent wall or on a post if it's not going to be out in the circulation route too much, then you might want to put it on a post. This makes it so much easier to roll up to it in a kind of a side approach. So all you have to do is you basically smack the control with your back of your hand, which I do all the time, and then just keep on rolling through the doorway. So, but again, the minimum requirement is that the clear floor space be outside of the swing of the door. We do, in the next slide, slide 68, we talk about maneuvering clearances, and we expect compliance with the same provisions of manual doors for automatic doors when it's a power-assisted door, which is the type of door that that may actually function where it takes over the opening after you've pulled on it. So you basically have to treat it like a manual door at the beginning of it, and then it takes over for you. So we'd require the clear space in those conditions. And then we also require the maneuvering clearance at automatic doors on accessible means of egress, again, because you're not going to have, it's going to function like a manual door when it's in an emergency situation. So, but we do give an exception for those with standby power or that have a stay open in the power off mode, which means they don't close, they actually just stay open, which is the easiest kind of door to get through. So there are two standards. We look at slide 69. There are two standards that apply that we reference. They're both BHMA ANSI standards. BHMA is Building Hardware Manufacturers Association. ANSI is the American National Standards Institute. These standards apply to both. The two different types of doors are power operated and automatic, power assisted and automatic doors. So we're going to talk about each one. If we go to slide 70, we're talking about the ANSI BHMA standard that is designated A156.10, which covers full power automatic doors. Now these are typically activated by mats or overhead sensors. They do not require actuation. They don't require a act of the person other than walking towards the door. They can be done with, like I said, an overhead sensor or with a mat. And they're often provided at retail facilities, airports, and other places like that. You've seen them where you just approach the door and it automatically opens and you haven't done anything special other than walk up to the door. Those are what is called a full power automatic door. And then we have in slide 71 the other type of ANSI BHMA standard, which is a low energy power assisted door. Now that covers a door that functions more like a standard hinge door, but with a power closer or opener option. Now this requires an act of the user to have it operate. So that's why there's the difference there. The other differences between these two standards is that there's a whole bunch of stuff about in the standards about the clearance requirements on a fully automatic door versus the low energy power assist doors. Now, on the next slide, slide 72, we talk about the reference standards. Both of the reference standards address sensors or actuating devices, how fast the door opens, safety features, sign requirements like automatic caution doors. Actually, it's caution automatic door, but I always like to say automatic caution doors. Sign requirements and then general performance of the door itself. Now, the other thing that these standards talk about are safety requirements of like the field that has to be clear for automatic doors so that somebody doesn't get whacked by the door when they go through it and other things like that. So there's a lot of technical stuff in these standards, but most manufacturers know what those requirements are, and they are aware of these ANSI standards. So, and again, these, as I mentioned, the automatic doors are not required. They are a good solution to a lot of problems you may have, and they do make entrances much more usable. But again, they are not required. But if you do provide them, they need to meet our requirements and the ANSI BHMA requirements as well. That's the next slide is slide 73, and that's when we're going to cover questions. So I've got some questions on automatic doors. does the ClearForce base set controls have to be centered? It's not specifically specified. It is probably, it's actually probably a good idea for it to be a little off-center so that it's easy to, like I showed in the slide with the side door, or with the sidewall, is that it may be easier to whack it with your hand if it's not exactly centered. But we do not specify that it has to be centered. And there is no specification for this minimum size of the control button, but they are pretty much standardized. They're pretty much the paddle. They can be square versus circles, but we don't specify the size. The control can be located on the inside, but it really makes the door a whole lot harder to use because you have to press the button and then maneuver all the way around the door to get through it. It's really kind of, I think when they get placed in those locations, it's somebody's not thinking about how an automatic door is used. So I would strongly recommend against it, but it technically is allowed because it would be outside the door swing. Now, if the door swings into that space on the inside, if it opens, say, more than 90 degrees, then I would say it can't be there because it would be within, because the door would swing into that clear floor space. So where do we want to go from here? Dave?
Okay, we did get some additional questions in, and I'll just review some of them. One of the questions asked whether all the requirements we talked about today were relevant to existing facilities as well. And keep in mind that the standards we've been reviewing, the ADA standards as well as the ABA standards, apply in new construction and alterations. These requirements are certainly useful if you're surveying an existing facility to identify barriers, but the requirements are applying when you build new or when you alter, and some of the provisions we noted, for example, where you are permitted an exception for existing, that's really provided in the context of an alteration to an existing facility. Now, we also had a question about if we could just recap the standards as they apply under the ADA and ABA statutes. And I'm just going to jump back to an earlier slide. that where we list the standards. Yes. Okay. Yeah. This slide on slide 5 is where we listed the applicable standards. On the ADA side, we have DOJ standards that pretty much apply to all facilities covered by the ADA. That's state and local government facilities, places of public accommodation and commercial facilities in the private sector, but not transit facilities that are part of designated public transportation. Transit facilities covered by the ADA are subject to DOT standards. Now, for federally funded facilities, we have coverage not under the ADA, but under the Architectural Barriers Act. And the standards issued under the ABA are very similar to those the revised editions of the ADA standards. They were implemented by the General Services Administration, which apply to most federal facilities covered by the ABA. Military facilities are subject to the Department of Defense's ABA standards, and postal facilities are subject to the Postal Service's standards. Now, the GSA, DOD, Postal Service standards are all pretty much the same. There's no really differences between them. They're all available on the board's website at www.access-board.gov. On our homepage, there's a link to the ADA standards, and you'll get links to the versions and their implementation dates and so forth. So the only ABA standard that has not been updated yet are those for housing issued by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And as a result of that, the existing UFAS standard still applies to housing. All other ABA facilities are subject to consistent, updated standards implemented by GSA, DOD, or the Postal Service, and they are very similar to those we now have under the ADA, but there are some differences between them. Now, we also had a question about we got a few questions about signage at doors, and we don't really have a lot of time left, so I would just like to point out that there is an archived webinar on signage that you may want to consult. We did address sign placement at doors and other provisions related to signs and doors, so one could check that out for more guidance in that area. And we also had a question about the exception for hospital doors. And the question was why that exception isn't limited to doors that are, say, at least 44 inches wide, which is a standard width to more commonly found in medical facilities to accommodate gurneys. The reason we did not tie the exception to a minimum clear width is because, in part, there was deemed to be major impacts on the configuration of patient rooms. A lot of times there is a partial wall to help provide some privacy when the door is open, and the basic footprint for these kind of bedrooms is one that is more significantly impacted where there's an across-the-board requirement for latch side clearance. So that's why it's not based on a minimum clear opening. And we did get a question about the provisions for the minimum 4-foot separation between doors, and how is this measured? Is it measured to the wall or to the door or door surface? That 4-foot separation is measured to the door. We also got a question about whether the requirements for thresholds apply to sliding doors, including those that may be located at a balcony off hotel rooms. And yes, there's no exception for the requirements, including those for thresholds at balcony doors, at least those that are serving mobility-accessible guest rooms. And we also had a question about if the requirements also apply to security doors or secure doors at something like a police facility and the detention area. We have provisions in the standards now that are specific to correctional facilities and detention facilities, including jails, and they require access to a certain portion of detention cells, holding cells, and so those doors on a route to an accessible cell, including the door serving an accessible cell, would have to be accessible. But as we mentioned, there are some exceptions for doors that are operated only by security personnel. So some provisions might not apply if the door is operated only by security personnel. We also had a question about whether hardware pulls, door pulls, must have at least a minimum 1.5-inch knuckle clearance, as is specified for grab bars. We don't have a specific requirement for that specification. So the depth behind a pull is not mandated, but basically anything that was designed to accommodate, a loose grip, or better yet, a closed fist, helps allow wider usability. And we also received a question about whether or not the requirement for the smooth surface is applicable to the pull side of doors. No, the smooth surface requirement is applicable only on the push side of doors. And we received a question about the signage and labeling accessible entrances. This question seemed to ask whether you need to label specific doors in the same location, or say, did you need to label an accessible door in a double door where only one leaf is accessible? We don't require that. We only require distinction and labeling and directional signage of the overall entrance. We do not further require that individual doors be identified as accessible or inaccessible. Well, we also had a question that we recapped the situation with screen doors, and what we would like to point out is that the screen doors are subject to these provisions. So, for example, maneuvering clearance, clear width, door hardware are applicable to screen doors, but we don't treat the screen door and the main door as doors in series. So that's the one distinction that's applicable. But yeah, we would actually recommend that in the case of accessible dwelling units, one not provide a screen door for easier access. And we're just looking through, seeing if there's any additional questions we could try and get to before we end today.
Let me take one that we have here, some manual doors, two rooms in accessible lodging, door has latch but no closer.
Scott, we're having some difficulty hearing you. If you get a little closer to the microphone.
All right, how about now? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's much better, Scott. Thanks.
Sorry, I had a dead mic. We're talking about manual doors with two rooms and accessible lodging. Door has latch but no closer. Does it require the latch side clearance? No. If you're on the push side of the door, we require that extra clearance only when there is both a closer and a latch. If it's one or the other, we don't require it. Now, on the pull side, we do require latch side clearance regardless of whether there is a closer or a latch. The closer or latch exception only applies to the push side of the door, not on the pull side. On the pull side, you are required to provide the latch side clearance if it's forward approach. Are there other questions that doors to work areas? We would require the door into the work area would need to meet the requirements of maneuvering clearance, but you may not require the maneuvering clearance back out again because we don't actually require you to be able to turn around in a work area. It's probably good design to make it so you can turn around in a work area, but it's not specifically required. Any other questions you'd like me specifically cover? Okay. On door, clear width is 4 inches, projection above 34 inches allowed on both sides of the door, net clear 24 inches. Yeah, that is technically true, but typically you're only going to get, this provision is really for hardware, for like panic hardware and things like that, and you're typically only going to get that protrusion on one side or the other. So we don't really expect it to ever happen on both sides, but I guess technically you may be allowed to do that by the provision, but I don't see that happening on any kind of regular basis. Sorry, Peggy's scrolling through the questions, so it's a little hard for me. Oh, the 4 inches that we were just talking about in the last question cannot project into the clear floor space. It can only project into the opening space, not the maneuvering clearance. So just so that's clear as well. Let's see. Is transient lodging, if the bedroom door swings into the bedroom, is acceptable if it obstructs the entrance to the bathroom that is inside the bedroom? Okay, this happens all the time. The hotels all over the place have doors that are competing with each other. It's not real good design to have the doors swinging into each other, but it is allowed as long as, because you're not really having to use the entrance door and then immediately go into the bathroom door, so we don't really consider a door in series. But good design would, like we've talked about when Dave talked about the maneuvering clearances being allowed to overlap, when the we do allow them to overlap, but we don't recommend that the door swings overlap, just the maneuvering clearances would overlap. So, okay, I'm going to turn this over to Peggy.
Okay, thanks, Scott and Dave. We're just about out of time now, and one thing we wanted to do is to show on the slide here, slide 74, our contact numbers, 800-872-2253 or TTY 800-993-2822. You can also reach us through email, ta@access-board.gov, and then finally, our website is www.access-board.gov. So if people have further questions regarding this material or any other of the provisions in the accessibility guidelines, feel free to contact us. Our technical assistance line is available from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And we look forward to these sessions each month, the first Thursday of each month. Our next session will be on July 7th, and that will be on accessible hospitals and other healthcare facilities. Same time, 2:30 to 4 Eastern Time. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Peter.
All right, thank you very much, Peggy, and thanks to Dave and Scott for their presentation today. An archive of today's session, an audio archive, will be available on the accessibilityonline.org website in approximately 10 business days from today. You can visit, view all of the archives of past sessions at www.accessibilityonline.org. On behalf of Peggy, Dave, and Scott, I want to thank all of you for joining us today, and we look forward to you joining us for future sessions within the Accessibility Online webinar series. To disconnect from Illuminate, simply close your internet browser. Thank you, and have a great day.